All right. Good evening, everybody. My name is Peter Mitwoody. I am serving as the Vice President of the American Physician Scientists Association this year, and it's my pleasure to host this interactive session with Dr. Kurt Weiss. A little bit about Dr. Weiss's background. Dr. Weiss grew up in Pittsburgh, I believe, so he is a Yinzer or a Pittsburgher or whatever they call him up there. Interesting thing. I'll let him talk about his personal history a little bit about what got him into being an orthopedic surgeon and orthopedic oncologist. But he did his undergraduate at Notre Dame and then went to Thomas Jefferson in Philadelphia for his medical school, and then did his residency at the University of Pittsburgh. He did the six-year program. You guys wouldn't mind muting your microphones just while this is going, if you don't mind, unless you're talking, that'd be great. So he did the six-year clinician scientist track program in orthopedic surgery at the University of Pittsburgh. He was actually the editor of the Pittsburgh Orthopedic Journal, which I know is a big endeavor. And then he went up for a tumor fellowship at the University of Toronto. And clinically, as I said, he's an orthopedic oncologist, so that he treats tumors of the soft tissue and bone, both operatively and non-operatively. And as far as his research, he is funded by the NIH. He has a K award, a K08, from the National Cancer Institute, and he studies sarcoma metastatic potential. And in the past, he's received funding from the Sarcoma Foundation of America. And while he was a resident, he got a resident research project grant from the Orthopedic Research and Education Foundation. He's very, very active both in his community and in medical societies. He's on the board of directors for the Connective Tissue Oncology Society. He was recently appointed a leadership fellow in the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons. And the Pittsburgh Business Times recently named him a 2015 healthcare hero. And as I said, he's active in the community. And one cool thing that I found out when I was on my rotation up there in July for orthopedics is that he helped organize and has for a number of years the Pittsburgh Cure Sarcoma Run, which is a 5K and walk, and they raise a lot of money for sarcoma research every year. And so I'd be remiss if I didn't say he was a proud husband and a father of three kids, I believe. Right, Dr. Weiss?
Two.
I thought I saw a picture of three. Sorry.
Yeah, two.
The two kids. So I'll just go ahead and start the first question. I see we've got I see Brandon on there from UAB. Welcome, Brandon. But I'll go ahead and start off with the first question. Since we've got a video here, we can make it fairly casual. But what motivated you, Dr. Weiss, to become an orthopedic surgeon? And I was hoping you'd talk a little bit about your personal history as a patient.
Okay, Peter. Can y'all hear me all right?
Yeah, it's perfect.
All right, cool. So when I was 15 and I was involved in training for spring training for football, I started having some pain in my right tibia and didn't think obviously much about it. And so took some ibuprofen and went on my way. Well, it didn't get any better and I started to get a mass, and my mother threatened me if I didn't go to the doctor, I would not be allowed to go mountain climbing with my friends. So to humor the old lady, I went to the orthopedic sports medicine doctor, because it must clearly be a sports medicine problem. And the long and short of it is that a sports medicine guy who hadn't seen a malignant bone tumor in 15 years diagnosed me. I was very, very fortunate, because a lot of times there's a significant delay in between the presentation of pediatric bone tumors and their appropriate and accurate diagnosis. So I was diagnosed with osteosarcoma, which is the most common primary tumor of bone that happens in humans, and had a bunch of surgery, a bunch of chemotherapy, failed both of those. I developed metastatic disease in my lungs, which necessitated me to join an experimental chemotherapy protocol, because I had no other choice, and had a lot of surgeries that ended with the amputation of my right leg from above the knee. So all these things sort of encouraged me to pursue a career in medicine and then into orthopedic oncology. I tried to enter medical school with an open mind, about not being an orthopod and not being a cancer doctor, but you know, sometimes you pick a job and sometimes it picks you, right, Peter? So I found that as much as I tried to not be an orthopedic cancer doctor, that's exactly what I ended up becoming anyway. And that's sort of the story. I did, so in terms of research, I started doing research in the laboratories at the University of Pittsburgh in the orthopedic department during the summers of undergrad because I needed to do something to strengthen my medical school application. But something happened that I did not expect, which is that I fell in love with the bench. And those first projects were on rheumatoid and osteoarthritis. I ended up getting a grant from the American College of Rheumatology to continue that research. Then during medical school, I did a summer research gig at MD Anderson in Houston. I took a year to do research with the Howard Hughes Medical Institute program. One of my residency years was a dedicated laboratory year, and there are a lot of those residencies available that have dedicated research time if you're interested. And when I came back, was recruited back to Pitt, it was to be the orthopedic cancer research guy. And so that's what I'm doing. Peter, I can't hear you, buddy.
Sorry, I didn't unmute myself.
There you go.
I just know I heard so many positive things both during my rotation there and during our interview there about a month ago from Dr. Fu about you and from lots of people. So I think your story is certainly inspiring, and I've had a good time getting to know you. One more quick question kind of along those lines, and then I can kind of open it up to Gerald or Brandon, or I think there's one other person right now. But I know you had an interest in both surgery and research, but would being a scientist not be easier in some other clinical specialty? And would being a surgeon not be easier if you didn't have the distraction of research?
Okay, well, so good questions. First, you know, the grass is always greener, isn't it? I do believe that it's easier for non-surgical physicians to do research. And the reason is because the way I do my job is with a skill. And if I don't practice that skill, then I lose it. And that I've got to cultivate that and keep that up. I can't, for example, just operate 3 months out of the year and then say, okay, if you need me, I'll be in the lab. I think it's much easier, not easy, but easier for non-surgical physicians to do that. The second part of your question was about the distractions of the laboratory when you're trying to see patients in clinic and do surgery. Surprisingly, well, okay, so here's a perfect example. I'm in my jammies. This is my research day. Tuesday is supposed to be my lab day. Well, I wasn't in my lab today. I was operating on my my partner's patient because my partner is on a medical mission in India, and a guy of his came in who needed to go to the operating room and needed to be looked after. So I had to do that. I didn't get into the lab today. So is that a distraction? I guess if you think about it concretely, the answer is yes. But I'm a big believer in the fact that the lab prepares your brain for what you see in clinic and vice versa. The clinic and the clinical experience is what separates us from just somebody who got a PhD in biochemistry right out of undergrad. And the clinic prepares your mind for the questions you want to ask and answer in the laboratory. So is that a distraction? Yeah, but it's also enriches your life.
That's great. Gerald or Brandon, do you guys have questions? Brandon, if you want to introduce yourself, I know Brandon, but...
There we go. Sorry about that. Messed with the mute button. But I'm Brandon Fox. I'm an MD PhD student at UAB, and I'm also interested in surgery and science.
Fantastic.
Me and Peter have been kind of going down this road together for quite a while. trying to figure out how to do it, because I'm sure you hear it all the time, how difficult it is, medical, it's not possible, on and on. But can you tell me kind of how your lab time, I know it's variable, because time certain time breaks down, and how you operate a lab? Do you have a PhD that works with you or a lab manager?
Sure. So in terms of time, the way it's supposed to work on paper, as we have seen from my experience today, doesn't always happen that way. But the way it's supposed to work on paper is Monday operative, Tuesday in the lab, Wednesday in the clinic, Thursday and Friday in the lab. That's the way my life is supposed to work. Sometimes, stuff comes up, and I'm looking after adults and children with cancer. When they need you now. Sometimes the lab suffers for that. Experiments can be repeated, but when people need you, they need you. So that's the way it's supposed to work. I do have a PhD that works with me. But my lab consists of, my personnel is, I get a research associate who's a PhD. I have a technician. I have a lab manager. I have two residents. And I have, right now, three medical students. So that's the team.
Okay, great.
What type of research are the medical students involved in?
The medical students, so I guess word's gotten out. If you work with me, you get on a paper. they will be learning basic bench work, basic statistics, helping out with existing projects. And then if their contributions are big enough, which they usually are, they can get on a paper, which is great for them, and it's great for us, and it's exciting to have them there. Actually, right now it's pretty exciting. My best medical student just kind of dropped this on me and said, hey, what do you say I take a year off of medical school and work in the lab for a whole year? And I said, that's great. Who's going to pay for it? He said, the university will pay for it. This is an existing program within the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. You can do that. You can take a year off to do a laboratory enrichment experience. So I was thinking about doing it. So that's going to be awesome. That's going to be like having another resident. And the residents are great because they have a dedicated research year in the laboratory. And so they just hit the lab and start cranking. They've been very, very good. Luckily, most of my help is free between the residents and the medical students. I have to pay for my tech. I have to pay for my lab manager partially. She's shared with some other folks, and I have to pay for my PhD. But everyone else is courtesy of the med school and the department.
So, Dr. Weiss, obviously the K Award is kind of this, supposed to be this kangaroo grant to get you to the kind of R level funding for the NIH. Is that kind of your goal? Kind of go head down that standard, surgeon scientist, well, it's not very standard, but physician scientist route to, then get a R01 or R21 or something like that. Is that kind of your goal?
Oh, yeah, for sure. So, I am well within, I hope. I got a real good score on a recent R21 I sent in. Which R21 is kind of funny for a lot of reasons, and we'll talk about that in a second. But I'll be writing my first R01 this year, and I expect that I'll get a poor score and I'll get kicked around a lot, but I'll get a lot of great suggestions. And when you have the security of the K, it's the time to do that. It takes a little bit of the pressure off. The K is really a neat mechanism because it forces you to put together a committee of mentors, a team of mentors that are going to help you, and you get some support. They bring you down to the NIH and you go to workshops and things. It's really a cool thing, and I encourage you guys to think about it. The application is a bitch. It's much more difficult to write a K award than it is an R21. I can write an R21 in a week if I have to. Now, I haven't gotten any yet, which probably means I've been trying to write them in a week too often. But I can still get it done. There's no way you can write a K award in less than a few months. So if you're thinking about doing it, make sure you budget yourself enough time. So can I talk about the weirdness of the R21?
Sure.
Yeah, let's hear it.
So R21s are kind of funny because it's supposed to be a high-risk, high-reward thing. And they say that you don't need preliminary data. Don't you believe it? Don't you believe it for a second? Absolutely need preliminary data, even for R21. And now, because funding is so tight, a lot of the big fish have lost their competitive renewals. And so they're kind of scrambling and trying to get some cash. So the competition for R21s is actually higher now than it is for R01s.
True.
So something to think about. That doesn't mean I'm going to stop applying for them. I'm absolutely going to keep applying for them. But it's not just like you fall off a log and you get an R21. It's not easy.
Yeah, and you're applying in one of the most you're applying NCI, I assume?
Yeah.
Is that pretty much – could you go the kind of the NIAMS route, or is that not even an option?
So that's a great question, Peter. When I submitted my first osteosarcoma grant, I did it to NIAMS, saying that, you know, this is a musculoskeletal disease, right? And they said, nah, kid, NCI. You know, we'll help you get it to where it's got to go, but you sent it to the wrong place. It's got to go to the NCI. Now, I'm working on a project right now that has a lot of crossover between sarcoma biology and muscle biology. So I may end up sending that to NIAMS, at least partially. You can sort of cross-list things. But, yeah, NCI is rough. NCI is no joke, that's for sure.
Right, so I kind of have a question about how you got on your feet and kind of got your first position and got the K award. So I've heard from many scientists that the, you know, postdoc phase, wherever you get it or however you do it, is really the most crucial phase, and having a good mentor there to springboard your career. Did you do that phase during residency, and how did you prove yourself enough to get a position where you have dedicated research time?
Okay, well, so how did I do that? I don't have a PhD. Are you an MD PhD?
I am, yeah.
Okay, so you and Peter are MD PhD guys. I did not do that. The way I sort of vetted or became vetted was doing research in the department as an undergrad, and then taking a whole year to finish a project in between undergrad and medical school. But most of the legwork was actually done in med school and residency. So I took a year to do the Howard Hughes Medical Institute program during medical school. That was huge. And I also did a summer research gig at MD Anderson in Houston, which was also huge. And then finally I did a research year during my residency, and to be honest with you, I was just plain lucky. I was very, very fortunate. Things worked out real well that year. So getting a good postdoc is not something that I am familiar with. I wish I could sort of counsel you a little bit better in that regard. But I can mentor you a lot on mentorship, because that's I'm finding out all the time what a huge, huge, huge deal that is, and unfortunately how much luck is involved in that.
Hmm. So for your mentors, Dr. Weiss, was it a, you know, there aren't that many prominent surgeon scientists. Obviously, UPMC has a good number compared to a lot of other places, but do you kind of have a combination of oncologists, you know, non-surgeon physicians, PhDs, kind of what, and also orthopedic surgeon scientists? What does that look like, kind of your
mentor program? My mentoring team, I've got five people on my mentoring team. My principal mentor is a lady named Steffi Oesterreich, who's probably the most prominent breast cancer basic scientist at the University of Pittsburgh, and the reason I became familiar with her work is because we collaborate on a project on metastatic breast cancer to bone. And I hate to tell you this, guys, but that was complete serendipity. And she's probably the best mentor I've ever had. Her interest in my career development is huge. She's a wonderful teacher. She gives me great advice. And I just can't say enough things about her. But I kind of lucked into that. So I've got her. I've got Ed Chu, who's the head of medical oncology at UPCI. Deb Galson, who is works on multiple myeloma, so she's kind of a musculoskeletal type person, but also a cancer person, so she's a great mentor to me. I've got Uma Rao, who's the head of musculoskeletal pathology, so she's important to have as a mentor and also for submitting grants. And finally is Dr. Tuan, Rocky Tuan, who, if you know musculoskeletal basic science, if you know Rocky Tuan, he's a big regenerative medicine guy. So from a completely selfish standpoint, if you're thinking about mentors, you want to think about, okay, so I'm preparing my R01, I'm preparing my R21, and I got to have letters of support. Who are they going to be from? Okay, and then that's a good place to start thinking about who's going to be a mentor to you. And I'm, you know, not necessarily for a K-Ward mentoring committee, although if you get that, that's awesome. But who is going to be your mentor? Like, okay, this is where I need support. This is what I'm not awesome at. This is where I need people to be my co-investigators, and find out who they are. And people, generally speaking, are very, very positive and giving people. I mean, if you've had success in this gig, you didn't grow up in a log cabin you built yourself, right? So if you've had success, it's because somebody mentored you. And I think that the people who are successful kind of get that and view it as part of the gig. It's part of the job to bring along young people and be good mentors in return.
It's very true. I've already experienced that with getting mentored and the mentoring younger folks. All right, other questions? I have a list I could kind of ask, but.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, sure.
My name is Vadim. I'm a third-year DO PhD student in Oklahoma State. I wanted to thank you very much for your talk. Your story is very inspiring. I really appreciate it. Everything so far has been very informative. I have a question for you in terms of the direction of research, deciding on the direction of research. So, you know, you've mentioned about publications are important, you know, especially for medical students as we're coming out applying to increasingly more competitive residencies. You know, publications are becoming a big part of almost a requirement for application. So, you know, as I am about in the middle of my first year of PhD now, and I've already decided on the general direction of my topic, but do you have any advice or suggestions as far as choosing the right topic that's both productive in the sense that, you know, it's an area where exploration is possible, publication is possible, and also something that that I would be interested in, you know, from your perspective of how you chose the direction, you know, of your research was very personal. You know, for me it's a bit different things that I'm excited about also, but do you have any general advice in that sense?
Okay, Vadim, that's an excellent question. I hope I give you what you're looking for. What you probably don't want to hear is that I don't think it's absolutely crucial at this stage, having just started your PhD, to pick something that you're going to be married to for the next 30 years. I don't think anybody really expects that. If you can get sort of in the ballpark of if you would like to be a surgeon, a pediatrician, a neurologist, sort of just get you somewhere within the same zip code of what you end up doing, you're going to be fine. Because you're going to have the rigorous scientific training that these guys have, and you're going to have gone through those paces such that when you get out as an attending, if you do something that's even remotely similar, you're going to be fine. So the biggest advice I can give you, Vadim, is you've done 2 years of you've done sort of the book work.
Yeah, yes, sir. So the first 2 years of medical school finished, and now in first year of PhD.
Okay. So I would say, scientifically, figure out what gets you going. My wife always says, don't ask what the world needs. Ask what excites you and go do it, because what the world needs is people who are excited. So I would say choose something that really appeals to you intellectually, and don't make that choice based on what you think. You know, it's tragic because there's always residents who say, well, you know, we're going to need a lot of total joint surgeons, so I should probably go and do joints. Well, that's pretty dumb because if you're going to wake up every morning wishing you were doing something else, or, oh, my gosh, if I have to hear one more whiny total hip patient, I'm going to shoot myself in the eye. That's the way to live. So find yourself a mentor who's working on something that you think is the coolest thing in the world, and that training will serve you. That experience will absolutely serve you no matter what you end up going into as a physician.
Okay. Thank you.
You got it, man. Good luck to you.
I have a question, Dr. Weiss, and it's about research. You obviously did the research track residency with a year of protected time, as you said.
Yeah.
And there are other options, you know, both certainly in non-surgical fields or the physician scientist track programs, tons of them in medicine and peds. Do you recommend doing that? And, you know, for somebody, let's say, did a PhD or not, has not done a PhD, but with significant experience, just to kind of get to doing specific research in that particular field, start going to these types of meetings in that particular field. Do you think that's a good idea?
I absolutely agree, Peter. I really, really do. At least in my experience, because that's when you start to separate out. I mean, obviously, you're doing that a lot now, getting a PhD. Okay, so you've already separated yourself to a large extent, but dedicating some time in residency to, okay, so we had a great question a minute ago about, you know, what do I need to do now that I'm just starting my PhD? Well, as you move forward and now you're a resident in orthopedic surgery or neurology or medicine or whatever, now you're starting to narrow things down a little bit and say, okay, this is my my scientific training, this is my medical training, how am I going to bring those together? And residency is the absolute perfect time to start sorting that out. Because you don't want to, what you want to try to avoid, Peter, is you get through your fellowship and you get a staff job and you're sitting at your desk and you say, shit, what am I going to do now? I've been working towards this for so many years and I finally got this job to do medicine and do science. And what the hell am I going to study? So I think doing research during your residency is a real good idea.
Thank you.
I wanted to dovetail on that. Go ahead.
No, I just had a quick question about those research residencies.
Yeah.
From my understanding is you pretty much have to have your PhD. I can't remember the guy's name, but at U of M, I was looking into an infectious disease short track residency, and I briefly spoke with him, and he said, pretty much, if you don't have your PhD, then don't even apply. Is that true for all of them?
It certainly is not for orthopedics. It is absolutely not for orthopedic surgery. In fact, So my year, Pitt takes 8 residents a year. 4 of them go straight through. 4 of them do a lab year. And out of the 4 of us, only one had a PhD. And I got to say that he wasn't the most productive guy either, you know, which is probably not what you guys with PhDs want to hear. But I do not think, at least in orthopedics and from what I've seen the other surgical subspecialties, you don't have to have a PhD to do a research year. Absolutely not.
Okay. I'm trying to get the experience through summer. I've looked into, I know Van Andel actually has a residency PhD program. It's longer, obviously, but it's an internal medicine residency and PhD program. We'll see about that. I'm not, like I said, the time, but anyways.
I hear you.
So my question kind of dovetails on the whole, you know, what am I going to study now? For you, did you build on your, you know, previous ideas that you did during residency, or did you kind of start de novo? And kind of what motivated your, you know, initial ideas in the lab, projects you were working on?
Yeah, so I was very, very, very fortunate. So my very first, you can always find something scientifically that's going to carry over, always. So I started out looking at different cytokines, interleukin-1 beta, and the interleukin receptor antagonist protein in rheumatoid arthritis, and the whole idea of gene therapy and trying to get the body cells to manufacture their own cure. That was what I did during undergrad, and also looking at genetic aberrations within the synovium of patients with rheumatoid arthritis. And then as I moved in more into oncology research, the idea of, you know, potential gene therapy for cancer and trying to understand how cytokines are important to the pathophysiology of sarcoma. Got the theory that osteosarcoma cells respond to, now this wasn't my idea, Marshall Urist had this idea 29 years ago, but nobody ever did anything with it. Osteosarcoma cells respond to the same cytokines as do normal bone cells, but in an inappropriate fashion. What happens if you put antagonists of, say, BMP2 onto bone cancer cells, what happens? So there's always going to be an evolution in your brain of where you've been to where you're at to where you're going. And I think it's damn near impossible to not make those connections. You will absolutely make those connections. There will be some way in your brain for you to draw on what you did at every stop along the way to move your project forward and do something that's uniquely yours. And I don't know exactly how that works out, but it seems to be a pretty recurrent theme when I talk to other young scientists that, yeah, when they worked in this lab and they studied this, and then as they went forward, they always kind of kept bits and pieces to form the nucleus of their research program when they finally get to a staff position.
Great, thank you.
Yeah, man.
So I have a question about leadership stuff, Dr. Weiss. So I'm sure you've already realized it, you know, as you start doing well in your career and progressing, I'm sure you've been asked either at conferences or at UPMC to serve on committees and board of directors, things like that. So how do you decide when you're going to say yes and when you're going to say no to kind of this, because you've got a lot going on clinically and with research, yeah, with family. So how do you kind of decide about those things?
Peter, that's also a great question. You do have to pick your battles, and you can't say yes to everybody. When you start out, it's very difficult. When you're young like I am, it's very difficult to say no to people, but sometimes you have to do it, especially when it comes to papers. So everybody and their mom is going to ask you to review papers. And it's cool to be able to put on your NIH biosketch that you review for these 15 different journals. And that's a nice thing to do. But that also, you pay the penalty for success in that you started getting requests to review things that really aren't where your focus is. And you've got to be able to say, this really isn't the focus of my research. I'm probably not the best person to review this particular article. Now, a lot of times, another time on the opposite end, let me talk to you about when you can't say no. So sometimes if mentors say, hey, you should do this, it'll be good for you. You got to do it, okay? Whether it's serving on IRB or a particular committee at your institution, if you've got someone you trust that says that you ought to do it, then you ought to do it. Like, and I'll give you a perfect example. This CTOS board of directors thing. It's not something I applied for. It's not something I expressed interest in. Jay Wunder and Laura Randall came up to me at the during the CTOS meeting and said, "We want you to do this. It'd be good for you. You'd be good for CTOS, and this position would be good for you." So that was that. You just can't say no to those kinds of things, especially from mentors whom you trust. Otherwise, if you're not sure, is this really something I want to spend your time on? The litmus test is, how close is it related to what I need to do? How close is it related to the people that I want to do it with, right? And what's the time commitment going to be like away from my family? And if you've got a mentor that you can bounce things off, you know, hey, Dr. Jones, I got asked to be on this committee. Is this bogus? Is this a waste of time, or is this something I should really do? And sometimes that, when you're new at an institution and you're new in a job, that's your safest port in the storm.
That's really helpful.
Great. So I guess the perfect time to ask this is, oh, sorry about that, Peter. This will be a quick one. But, one thing that's always been a recurrent theme when I've been considering should I do surgery or not with science is work-life balance. So how do you make it work with your family? I guess that's a short question.
I have an awesome wife. That's the main thing. You find yourself the right teammate, you're going to be fine. Because your teammate wants you to be happy. Now, I'm going to say something that might come as a little bit of a shock, and that is, if you think you can be happy doing something other than surgery, do it. Because it's a hard gig. It's very challenging. It's long training. We punish our families a lot. But if you're going to wake up every morning wishing you were in the operating room and being jealous of people who are in the operating room, and God made you to be a surgeon, then you're kind of stuck. Then you got to do it. And believe me, if you found yourself the right teammate, your teammate wants you to do that. Your teammate wants you to come home tired but happy. So that's the best advice I can give you. Get yourself a good teammate, and really look inside your heart, and if you think you're going to be miserable doing anything other than surgery, then do surgery. But if you think you could be just as happy doing something else, do something else.
Great. Thank you.
Is that not the answer you wanted? It's a little blunt.
Well, it's actually very similar to some answers I've gotten from others, you know, people who are in surgery and science. So I like to hear that because, you know, the more you hear it, the more you really believe it. Especially, you know, I can imagine the jealousy of other surgeons if you were a medical doctor type thing. So yeah. I appreciate the comment.
So, and I can tell you that they don't happen often, but on those days when you do surgery in the morning and see some patients at noon and go to the lab in the afternoon, I don't stop smiling like for the rest of that day. That is the best day ever, where you get to operate, you get to spend some time in clinic, and you get to go to lab. There's just nothing better in the universe. That is the best day ever.
Very cool.
Maybe having a scotch at the end of the day would make it more perfect, but that's a good.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like you found the right job, Dr. Weiss. Other questions? I guess we can start to wrap up. I think we've had a really good session and very productive, lots of good questions. But any other questions?
I have a basic one as a medical student. There's a lot of different people that have different types of research. Like I said, I'm pretty confident about infectious diseases, but I haven't done my clinical rotations yet. So, mm-hmm. and I'm not doing a PhD, so I mean, I guess my biggest experience will be the clinical rotations. You think that's a good time to find out what's really, you know, what type of research I'd like to do? Even though right now I'm thinking infectious diseases.
Talk to the guys and ladies that are your mentors on your rotations. Do you have a lab? What are you looking at? I'm fascinated by the idea of mycoses. Who's doing fungal research at this university? Or, you know, the things that really get you going. Go ahead and show that inquisitiveness. First of all, it'll help you to get a better grade. But more importantly, it can get you hooked up with somebody that can plug you into an existing project that maybe can help you out getting you where you want to go in terms of fellowship. But I think showing that interest, showing that inquisitiveness is very important on your rotations. And Gerald, we are not so dumb. We appear dumb, but we're not so dumb that we can tell when people are bullshitting and when they're not. So if you come with an honest passion and excitement about problems and infectious diseases and you really want to get involved, that's going to show through.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
You got it, man. Best of luck to you.
Yeah, thanks.
All right. Well, I guess we'll wrap up there. I think this has been a good session. We're a little bit early, but I think that's fine. I know it's 9:50 Eastern time, so it's a little later up there, but I wanted to thank Dr. Weiss, and I want to thank all the attendees who showed up, and also for the people who are listening to the audio after the fact. So thank you guys for joining.
Hey, thanks, fellas.